It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. What a great show we have. It's the experienced tech journalists this week. Mike Elgin, Larry Magid, Dwight Silverman join us. We'll talk about changing social media habits and maybe the end of the line for social media entirely. Messaging and why it needs to be standardized. The Galaxy S9, is it good enough? Is it not good enough? And is it even necessary? Plus Microsoft's fight over data privacy. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 656, recorded Sunday, March 4th, 2018. A camel with your name on it. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first order with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. You can save $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit and using the promo code TWIT at checkout. And by stamps.com, buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWIT. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we get together every week at the end of the week and kind of analyze what happened with some of the best tech journalists in the business. This is the Over 50 Club today, and I like doing this every once in a while. Get the senior tech journalists in the room to weigh in, starting with Mike Elgin, who's been covering the scene for several decades. He's in France tonight, and I mean tonight, because almost, it's like midnight there.
It's getting toward midnight. And here in France, we, me and the French people here, we just couldn't care less about the Oscars.
Oh, really? Okay. I guess that makes sense.
Bourgeois.
The French have their own Oscars, right? There's some sort of French ceremony. And Jerry Lewis wins every year. No, that's
right.
Not
amazing.
True. Not true. Anyway, Mike, it's great to have you. He's doing his digital nomad thing, for which he is justly famous. And we'll ask him in a little bit what the plans are. Also with us from Houston, Texas, Dwight Silverman. So glad Dwight's back in the fold. He's a lapsed tech journalist for a while.
I saw the error of my ways. I'm back, baby.
I am relieved. He's the tech burger at the Houston Chronicle. You should spell that with an H, so that you'd be like the mayor of tech.
Well, one of the things that it lets us do is we actually do have hamburger reviews and news on the tech burger page. So every now and then, like on our Twitter account, our Facebook account, I'll throw up one of our food critics' hamburger reviews, and everybody goes, "What? It's a tick." What? So it lets me do a running inside joke that I'm the only person who gets it.
I can't go to your page. It makes me too hungry. It looks delicious, that tech burger. Also here from CBS News Radio. Larry, I got it right. Larry Magid.
Yeah, very good.
Nice to see you, Larry.
Good to see you.
Also longtime journalist.
Yeah. And you know, this over 50, one of my Facebook friends is proposing a 50 over 50. You know how Forbes has 30 under 30 where they celebrate
all the
young
Oscars?
Yeah, what about us old guys? And you know, there are so few of us that we all might make it in that list.
They don't care about the over 50.
There's only 50 of us left.
That would be everybody.
Exactly. Right. 75 over 75 will definitely make that one.
This is a reunion of sorts with Larry and I. Larry and I co-wrote a book together. It was the first time I had been involved in a book. Yes, we wrote a Vista book.
I had no idea.
Three copies. Yes, I had no idea.
My mother bought one. My dog bought one. I think Dwight might have bought one. That was it.
Truth is, you know, and I'm sure that there we have lots of young viewers, and they always say, you know, you ought to get some people under 25, and that's fine. And certainly people under 25 have a perspective on tech, but we've been around to watch it happen over the last few decades. And I think there is something of value there, too, because I think you get some perspective. You don't jump when Snapchat releases glasses. Oh, this is the next best thing. Of course, Mike liked those Google goggles a lot, the Google Glass.
I do, but the Snap glasses are something entirely different. do not like those. The kids these days with their glasses.
Pew's annual study of actually they do it all the time, but they've come out with their big findings about how young people use social media. I don't know if you guys saw these graphs that came out yesterday, but boy, it's a shocker and it's not a shocker. I'm going to go down to the YouTube because that's one that's really interesting. It comes down to age, actually. Let me see if I can I can find it. It turns out, where's the breakdown by? Here it is. Social platforms: YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, and Twitter. Now let me explain it because it's kind of a complicated graph. The green dot is 50 plus, you and me.
Us. Yep.
Yep. The dark green. The dark blue is 18 to 24, and here is the gap. So, for instance, the percentage of U.S. adults in each age group who say they use YouTube: 94% of 18 to 24-year-olds. It's a little bit less for us old folks, 56%. 80%. Actually, the only place Facebook doesn't do well is with people in their 60s. Facebook is completely dominant. 80% of people between 18 and 50, 80% use Facebook. This doesn't say, but I think it's every day. Yeah. Snapchat, 78%. Instagram, 71%. There's just no question that there's a younger trending thing with everything but Facebook.
I think what this actually doesn't say is that each sort of age group has its own go-to main source of information about the world. And I think that for older people, it's television still. Yep. And I think for younger people, it's YouTube for sure. And so you really see this when you start asking people who are 20, 22 or whatever, or younger, about, you know, everyday ordinary TV stars or movie stars or whatever. They don't necessarily know who those people are. But the YouTube stars, they have an encyclopedic knowledge about these personalities. And most of these names would be completely alien to all of us on this panel.
You know what's interesting? You know, I run Safer Internet Day every year, and we're always trying to get a YouTube star to, you know, come and be a speaker. They charge as much for appearances as some of the Hollywood stars. I mean, these guys are, you know, I'll come and speak for $100,000. And by the way, in the Civic Youth, if you go to the front page of connectsafely.org, you'll find I have an article called Teens and Social Media. It's a mixed bag. I had to go look at it. And part of that is taking on this psychologist, Jean Twenge. I don't know if you've covered that.
Yes, study. We have.
And one of the things that she's shocked about is that as a result of social media, young people are having less sex, drinking less, and driving less, as if those are necessarily bad things, or, you know, that kids are doing that. But I basically have taken on this whole argument, and part of I'm basing it on is what's happening in Parkland, Florida. I mean, that's anecdotal. It's just a few key kids, but I am convinced that young people are more engaged than my generation was. And I come from a pretty engaged baby boomer generation and not as socially isolated. And I have no idea how much sex they're having, but you know, maybe that's a good thing. They're not having that much sex.
We talked a lot about her book, which is called iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, which is the ultimate link bait. In fact, she was so anxious to get link bait, she threw in about 18 concepts in one subtitle. But
worst subtitle ever.
Yeah. Well,
those kids in Florida, I mean, I'm sorry, those kids that are leading the anti, you know, the gun control movement,
it's pretty impressive,
are actually more like adults than the people who are running our country. Yeah. So
that's right.
Well, and I guess what you could say is that these are kids who deeply understand social media, and actually, as it turns out, mainstream media. And so because they're so activated by this issue, are showing a real adeptness. Well,
the skills that they developed on both sides of the cell phone camera work on and mainstream media as well. It doesn't matter whether you're doing a YouTube video or you're on CNN. If you're telegenic and know how to talk to a camera, those skills are going to work for you. And they've proven it. They've also proven amazing mastery of social media. And by the way, I think Emma Gomez has far more followers than the NRA does. Which is pretty remarkable.
You know, one thing that the Pew thing I don't think really addresses is it's not so much, I think, where they get their news, but how they talk to each other. You know, each of the generations has a channel where they talk with their friends and their family, and news just happens to be a part of it. You also see in a lot of these surveys and previous Pew surveys that people don't think of, oh, I'm going to go to Facebook to look at news. Mm-hmm. That's not what happens. They go there to interact with their friends, and if news that's interests them shows up, you know, it's gravy, but I don't think that people like jump onto Facebook and say, let's see what the news is today.
Well, that may have changed quite a bit because Facebook has changed its algorithm to kind of deprecate news. The That's Pew sure. study did say, they don't specifically address news, but they did say now roughly 2/3 of U.S. adults, 68%, say they are Facebook users, 3/4 of them on a daily basis. So this is actually really across all demographics. Facebook is dominant. But it's interesting. I mean, this is how much power Facebook wields. They decide all of a sudden, yeah, we're not going to do so much news. A number of news organizations fold immediately. The rest are suffering. And mm-hmm. People still go to Facebook. It's not where they go for their nose. It's just where they go for whatever is there, right?
Yeah, there also have been a series of studies that have shown that search now is outperforming in terms of referrals to news sites.
I saw that.
Social media.
Yeah.
And we've seen that. We see that at the Chronicle. What's also interesting is that at the same time, actually on one day, Facebook said there'd be less news. And then the next day, they said there'd be more local news. And we have seen some of that happening here as well.
That was a Neiman Lab report that just recently, in fact, I think at the same time as this Pew report came out, showed that referral traffic from Facebook, and we knew this, is becoming less important, but that's not all bad. Actually, I think they're talking about BuzzSumo here, which is a terrible name for an analytics company.
Almost as bad as TechBurger.
Yeah, but BuzzSumo doesn't invoke a lovely image of a juicy hamburger.
That's right.
It evokes an image of a cocaine-addled wrestler. I don't know what... So, in any event, according to BuzzSumo, look at the shares here, for instance, of New York Times content going up and up and up. Some of that, of course, is bolstered by the interest in politics in the last year. But and they're getting a lot of their links, as you said, not from social sharing sites, but in fact from search engines.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which I find ironic because Rupert Murdoch is suing Google because he's complaining about the fact that they're linking to his sites, which I never understood since it brings people in. But
so he's now suing because he launched.
Why not be suing? He's complaining.
He's complaining. Yeah. He launched the first shot by saying they ought to pay me.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I love it when people link to my articles. That's the whole idea, isn't it? To get viewers.
And we've seen examples in Europe where was it Germany or France where the publisher said no more. You can't link to us anymore. And there it was Spain. And the readership plummeted, and they said, "Oh, I'm sorry, forget I said. please link back to us. We want that." Here's the telling graph. The blue line is Google referral traffic. The green line is Facebook referral traffic, and the scale is over the last year. So the lines have completely shifted. It was Facebook on top. And now Facebook is well below Google.
And is anybody else finding Facebook more boring since they changed the article?
I never go to it.
I just seeing the same stories from the same people over and over again, and I it's not as diverse as it was before.
I liked all that link bait.
Yeah, really.
Well, I use Facebook primarily to keep up with my friends and people who are far away. I use it actually much less for news. And as soon as I go into it, I flip the feed so that it is chronological.
Me too.
As opposed to algorithm. Yeah. And then you see a lot more. The problem is it won't stick like that.
I know. I always forget to do that.
That is the annoying part of it, I think.
So let's see. We talk more about social media use? Maybe there's some more tidbits in here. Well, we did see Facebook said at, I think it was at their quarterly results, that they had 2 million, a loss of 2 million users in the under 25 age group. So I think there is some erosion among the younger people, but they seem to be making that up with adults. So,
and also with Instagram, which they own. So it's like,
And that's the best strategy, isn't it? Right. Just buy some other things.
And now they got Messenger Kids, so they can get even younger kids and as part of the fold.
Snapchat, 78% of 18 to 24 year olds use Snapchat, 54% as soon as they go over 24.
Although Snapchat has issues right now with its redesign and people not being happy about that.
And Kylie Jenner. Kylie Jenner's not happy about that. Pinterest, here's a surprise, more popular with women. Who'd have thunk?
Really?
Yeah, 41% of women say they use the site, 16% of men.
Right.
Never would have guessed.
Never would have thought. Latin America, the number one area for WhatsApp. We knew that because when the Brazil tried to shut down WhatsApp, there was practically a rebellion in the streets, and they brought it back within 24 hours.
WhatsApp is the weirdest thing that America, where America is out of step with the rest of the world, because everyone in the world uses WhatsApp except Americans. And everywhere we go around the world, everyone's like, well, that's the primary way that people stay in touch with each other. And in the U.S., it's like, you know, maybe some people use it, but almost nobody uses it as their primary means to stay connected
to
anyone.
Is that purely economic, because most cell phone plans have unlimited texting here, but not in other countries?
I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea why it is.
And I think WhatsApp is big in Latin America and Europe, but not in Asia, where Line and WeChat totally are dominant.
I know the most Americans I know that use it to communicate with people overseas.
Yeah.
They don't use it. You know, they keep it handy, which, by the way, WhatsApp is also owned by Facebook. So.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
I took them all off my phone because I don't want Facebook to get any additional data from me. I still have accounts, but I just don't use them on my phone. It's also because I was staying up late at night. Waking up in the middle of the night looking at Instagram is not a good habit.
I know quite a few people who have taken all of these social apps off of their phone, and they now only use it on a computer. And that's a really interesting – I don't know how much of a trend that is, but I know quite a few people who've done it, and now you, Leo.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of apps that you can't use on a computer that you have to use on a phone if you want to use them, which bothers me. I wish they would. I'm one of these people who, you know, never goes anywhere without a laptop, and I would rather use a computer for anything that requires typing. But I guess I'm another old guy that out of touch with the youngins.
Are we at a disadvantage in the U.S. because we have so many messaging platforms that it's fragmented?
I find that a problem because you have to figure out the
I would love it if everybody would use Telegram, for instance. Right. I love the platform. I would be very happy, but I can't use it with a handful of people who are on it.
Imagine if back in the day when we were kids and you picked up the phone and you had to know what phone company the person on the other end was using in order to call them.
Well, you know what the analog is email. Remember in the early, old enough to remember MCI mail and GE mail, and you couldn't email somebody across services, CompuServe, but then at some point, I can't remember exactly when it happened, once you could email everybody from any service, that completely changed email for the better.
Well, you know, you're bringing up an interesting pet peeve of mine, which is I think that the mobile world has set us back in a number of ways. I remember when every communication service has had its own piece of software, right? You wanted to go on Prodigy, you used the Prodigy software. You wanted to go on CompuServe, you used their software. And then there's this marvelous thing that came along called the World Wide Web, and suddenly every communication service we wanted was available on the same piece of software with a URL. Now in the mobile world, it's a separate app for everything you want to do. And so I actually think we've moved backwards.
I completely agree.
You know, even like newspapers, if I want to read the Washington Post.
It's all siloed.
We're back in the silo.
One of the ways we've moved backwards is in advocacy, because back in the old days when IRC and AIM and all these different chat messaging services were incompatible, there was a lot of pressure by the using public for them to unite and figure out how to be cross-platform and so on. And you don't see that at all. Nobody's calling on Facebook to be compatible with Twitter and all these other social networks. And we should be. We should be trying to squeeze the social networks so that you can go to a single social network. I mean, remember that Facebook purchased, what was it, Feedster, whatever it was, which was an attempt to unify different social networks. They bought it and killed it because the last thing they want is for people to be able to interact with multiple social networks all in one platform.
Sure. I mean, there are ways your Twitter feed can show up on Facebook, but I don't know any way, for example, that maybe other people do, to exchange photographs between Instagram and Snapchat. And it seems to me you're right. You should just choose the platform you want to use rather than having to choose it based on what your friends are using. And that's actually, you know, we studied some of these social media apps, and it's not the app that drives people to a particular platform. It's what their friends are using. And so if all your friends are on Snapchat, you're going to be on Snapchat as opposed to just picking whatever platform you enjoy using.
It's a challenging balance because another example here would be restaurant reservation apps. And I'm not advocating, by the way, somebody in the chat room said, you're advocating monopoly. No, quite the opposite. I'm advocating a standard.
Right.
Because if you had a standard, then you could use any app you liked better than any other app, but they'd be able to interoperate, like email is.
Travel arrangements.
Yeah. I mean,
Expedia, Orbitz, it doesn't matter. They all take you to the same database.
Yeah, but that's because you're ordering from the same people ultimately.
That's true.
Right.
But email is a better example. You know, you can use any email client you want, but there's email standards, and that's how you interact with one another. Restaurant reservation. So here's the pros and cons. If you're a restaurant, you know, there are other considerations like how much it costs, how much of your profits you have to give to them. That's one of the problems Open Table has. A lot of restaurants hate Open Table. But if you're a restaurant, you'd like to be on some digital reservation system. As a user, though, I have to figure out which system that restaurant uses. Some use Resy, some use Open Table. They're more and more, and there's going to be this proliferation, and that makes all of them less useful. It hurts all of them. So there's an economic incentive for you know, Apple and Google and Facebook to say, use our product and none other. But at the same time, you can get to, unless you have dominance, it could hurt you in the long run because then nobody wins, right?
And we were talking about generational differences in attitudes and in terms of what people do. Our generation, we're a bunch of attention whores. We want to be able to reach everybody. Like, we want a one-to-many megaphone to reach everybody. And that's why it's a problem for us that there's not a single platform where we can post and everybody on all our friends on Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, Instagram, et cetera, can see that same post. That's a problem for us. But for young people, they don't want a megaphone. They don't want to, they don't want one-to-many communication. They want to find a place where their 12 friends or 8 friends or whatever are there and just have this small group communication. In general, I'm generalizing.
That's changing, though, because you're seeing, for instance, somebody's pointing this out also in the chat room, that a lot of people are using the Snapchat filters, saving them and then posting them on Instagram, the competitor's platform. So I think young people even want, by the way, this show has turned into exactly what I thought it would, which is a bunch of old folks complaining about the kids.
Get
today.
Off my lawn.
But I do think young people, ultimately, I think everybody, if they can experience it, would want open platforms.
Well, the you know,
except
the
for the companies who are profiting off closed platforms.
Right.
Well, you know, we're complaining that we want interoperability, but you don't hear everybody else complaining about it. And there's which means that for them, it's working. You know, Apple is kind of a good example of how it works. You know, the walled garden, Apple's buy-in, where lock-in, where you end up having, you know, I think probably the perfect example of this is the Messages app, where if you're talking to someone who's using an iPhone or an iDevice or a Mac, and you're texting at them using that, you have this pleasant blue. And then when you're talking to someone who is using an Android or some other device, it's this like ugly green, you know, it's like, all right, it looks barbaric.
And they make the video and pictures like lower quality,
savages.
Which is another problematic.
Apple but Apple's the king of ecosystem lock-in. They know exactly how to do it. But I would submit that
they don't complain.
That the this is one, but I think there are other data points. The fact that people use Snapchat to create something and then save it on Instagram shows that even though they don't know to say the words open platform, that's really what people want. They want to use the right tool for the right job. They just don't know what to call it. because they've never experienced it. Well, nobody wants the ecosystem lock in.
What they also don't know is Instagram has the same filters. So well, they're rapidly, using the Snapchat filters.
They're stealing them all. What it doesn't have, though, Snapchat really owns this face thing where you could put stuff on there. Yeah. Nobody does it better than Snapchat. Apple's trying to with an emoji.
Actually, Messenger Kids did a pretty good job on it.
Did it?
If you're under 13, yeah, for kids, yeah.
So how do you stand on Messenger Kids? Because this seemed to me to be the most naked grab for power of all. Facebook created, COPPA prevents us from making under 13-year-olds use our platform. I know. We'll create Messenger for kids.
All right. Now you got me on a roll here. I am a big fan of Messenger Kids.
Really?
And I have to disclose that Facebook is a supporter of my nonprofit, connectsafely.org. We have to say that. But you know, I was involved in pre-briefing and actually in some ways calling for it over a period of years with those guys, trying to get them to do a project for people under 13. And what I like about Messenger Kids is, number one, it's totally under parents' control. The parent's required to set up an account. The parent has to approve every single contact. It is not a social media platform. It is a messaging platform designed so kids can talk to their family and other children. It has delightful, you know, gifts and masks and other fun things you can do with it. And unless the parent screws up, it's completely safe. Now, a parent can go ahead and let your creepy uncle communicate with you, but that's on the parent. It's not on Facebook. Facebook has given parents complete control.
My objection is you shouldn't get kids on these messenger platforms at all.
They're on it anyway. If you believe in that, then they shouldn't have devices. The fact is that millions and millions of young kids have devices. And once they get a device, they're going to find some kind of messaging platform to play with. And if it's not Facebook Kids, Messenger Kids, it's going to be Snapchat or Instagram where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's
campaign for a commercial-free childhood. Yeah. Bunch of experts, pediatricians, child psychologists, wrote a letter to Mark Zuckerberg saying, please discontinue Messenger Kids. Younger children are simply not ready to have social media accounts. They're not old enough to navigate the complexities of online relationships. At a time when there's mounting concern about how social media use affects adolescents' well-being, it's particularly irresponsible to encourage children as young as preschoolers to start using a Facebook product. Maybe the answer is, if you're a certain age, Larry, like if you're 9 or 10, you're old enough to have a device and want a device. Yes, but there's kids 5 years old using Facebook Messenger.
Yeah, but you know, I just came back from the Facebook Global Safety Summit in Washington. It was actually on Thursday, and we had pediatricians. There are plenty of experts. I don't like calling myself an expert, but I've been in the child safety space now for 20 years. And there are plenty of people who would argue that Messenger Kids is a good thing. Now, like anything else, it has to be done with parental control. You can't let the kids spend too much time using the device. There's all sorts of things that parents need to do. But the mere fact that you're letting kids interact with their friends and their family, I don't know. I think that I just don't agree with these folks that are making a big play on this. I mean, they have a right to do it. And I've respectfully disagreed in several public forums.
Good.
Including on LarrysWorld.com.
Good. So. And then there's Vero. Do we need another social media app? This is a social media app that has been around for several years, but for some reason that I don't really understand, suddenly...
I think I know the reason.
Oh, tell me. It suddenly took off. They were offering free for life subscriptions for the first 1 million users.
That's the reason.
It's up to 3 million now. And they said, due to extraordinary demand, we're going to extend this offer. Is that the reason? Because it's free? But at some point, it might not be?
As it approached the million, people are thinking, well, if this thing blows up and suddenly this is the social network,
get on it
and
now.
It costs $20 a year for the rest of my life, might as well sign up. And those signups caused an avalanche of users, which caused some news reports and people started discovering. So I really think it's nothing more than that. Now, they had so many problems with new signups that they actually extended the for life thing.
And I think they've solved their server issues. I've been using it for a week and it seems to be fine.
Yeah.
I like it that it's more content focused. When you start to put a post up, it really encourages you to share about a book or a movie or a picture. There are a lot of beautiful images on it. It's a pretty looking program. It also has some nice privacy controls. You choose whether people you are following are close friends, acquaintances, or followers, and you can share it with either publicly or with a small group. It's very pretty. I actually took it off my phone because too many people were joining it and I was getting nonstop notifications.
Yeah. they don't have a family category, which is a little weird.
That would be nice. It's yeah.
Rough around the edges. But what's great about it is it basically reminds you of how stupid Instagram is. So
yeah.
Instagram, you can't put links. You can't do like, you have all these artificial limitations designed to keep you locked into
this
Instagram.
This has Google Plus style threaded conversation, not threaded, but conversations as well. You can have comments on there. Here's the issue though. And I'm really curious what you guys think about this, because I've been debating it with everybody here at Twit. There is some question about its founder. you know, he's the son of the former Lebanese prime minister.
Yeah,
he's a billionaire. This is the Gizmodo article that kind of started it all. And I have not done any research. He denies this, but Gizmodo says that there's some evidence that he had his previous startup didn't pay its employees, left people to starve, did some nasty stuff. I don't know if we can prove or disprove that. There are plenty of people defending him on Vero. But I guess my question is, should we care about the provenance of a program like Vero?
Well, I think you don't want to enable somebody who has done bad things to do it again. I think that's the main concern. There are other issues with this, too. And that is, if you look at the terms of service, it gives them complete rights to do anything with any of the content that you upload in perpetuity. To a degree that is not found in a lot of other.
It's worse than Instagram's terms.
Worse than Instagram, okay. worse than Facebook's. And Facebook, at one point, had the same type of language and was doing things like, if you remember the flap where they were taking people's faces and putting them next to products and say, likes, so that would appear.
Ooh, I hated that.
Yeah, Vero, in theory, could do that based on on the way this is worded. Okay. So that's something to be aware
that's
of.
Maybe
that's more concerning
tangible
to me.
Argument. Yes. And of course, there's another question is, do we need another social network? And will this be another example of a flash in the pan social network that everybody joins but nobody uses and everybody goes back to Facebook and Twitter afterwards?
Like Elo. Yes.
Like Elo.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I can go on and on. Like Mastodon, which is the Twitter clone that everybody was excited about.
Only if there's a backlash. I mean, you know, we're going through a tech backlash now, and I don't think it's affected at least adult users of Facebook. But if this backlash gets to a point where people feel that Facebook is A, inundating us with too much advertising, or B, taking away our privacy, or C, putting us in the hands of Russian manipulators, then I could see some interest in people going off to a different type of platform that's less reliant on advertising and perhaps more reliant on a subscription basis. I don't think you're talking about hundreds of millions of users, but I could definitely see some people wanting to move into a premium service, being willing to pay for it in exchange for them at least having the sense that they're getting better privacy.
I like the idea of advertising. What I don't like is algorithmic sorting. So what I want,
which by the way, they say they don't do. Vero says we won't do that. This is a chronological timeline. Yeah, right.
But everyone else does it, and it's considered a sort of a technological advantage to be able to do that really well. But the problem is, what I want is to be able to follow people and get the things that they post. That's right. What I want, and it's like impossible to find something like that. They're always messing around with it and give me posts of people that I don't follow. They're taking away posts of people I do follow because their algorithms decide that I don't need to see it. I'm tired of that BS. What I'd like to see is like something like a BitTorrent or something, a distributed peer-to-peer non-commercial social network where the data is distributed like BitTorrent is, but the interface is governed by some sort of open source thing, and just get away from these gigantic companies that are just making money hand over fist, manipulating our emotions and manipulating our relationships.
So you think there's an opportunity for an alternate social network now that does it right, and that people would?
No, I don't. I don't think there's an opportunity.
That's just what he wants.
Google Plus was going to be that, right?
Right. Well, there was a startup a few years ago that was reacting to Facebook. I can't remember the name of it. But it
Hello,
was open-
Diaspora. Yeah. So this is funny. Right. At the bottom of the Gizmodo article about Vero, there's other links you might be interested in. Whatever happened to Facebook killer Diaspora? What is LO and should I even bother? What is Path? What is Google? Gab, the Twitter clone for trolls. What is Peach? These are all failed social networks designed to replace the existing.
Yeah. The only difference is this backlash that's going on right now. And I don't know how much steam it's going to pick up.
Yeah.
It's a different time, but I don't know if it's going to pick up enough steam to drive people into the arms of a competitor. But it is happening.
You know what I predict?
Not just Facebook,
I think
Google,
the backlash
well.
Is against social, not against those just those particular sites, but against social in general. At least that's what I feel like in my life. I actually am glad not to visit Twitter every day, Facebook every day. And I put Vero on here. I thought, it's beautiful. It's nice. I really like the platform, but I don't want to spend time there either. I think there may be a backlash that doesn't transfer everybody to the next social thing, but people may just have had enough of social. We've seen some very negative impacts on
there
our
was
lives.
There was a piece from the, I believe it was The Conversation, which is a site that kind of puts together thinkers and different people doing essays about society. They had a really great piece at the end of last year called, and this is the headline I put on it because I ran it on TechBurger, but it was 2017: the year we fell out of love with our smartphones.
Oh.
And it was essentially when we began to look at the devices as taking up too much time, robbing us of real life. A lot of blame of what happened in the 2016 election, I think, falls on social networks on mobile. And I think that there is, among thinkers and talkers and doers, I think there's a backlash. You know, you don't see a lot of, I think, of mainstreamers complaining on Facebook about how they're on Facebook too much. Yeah, that's the post. And I don't think that, you know, however, people are cognizant of the backlash. And I think over time, I think you're going to see usage cut back. And even Mark Zuckerberg has said people should spend less time on Facebook.
Right.
So I think
he's actually advocated it. He's actually argued that people should spend less time on Facebook. Now, how he means that is another question, but that was a big conversation that came up again at this Global Safety Summit. Is somebody said, is Facebook like a tobacco company or like a chocolate company?
Oh,
which is a very interesting notion. So tobacco's purpose is, there's no such thing as a modest amount of smoking. You know, one cigarette's bad for you. Whereas chocolate, chocolate's great in moderation
bit.
And kill you if you eat too much of it.
I think maybe, on the one hand, maybe we are tiring of it. On the other hand, I think we're as likely to give up Facebook and Twitter as we are to give up coffee. It's an addictive substance.
The really bad news is that we're kind of plateaued with social networking and on smartphones, and we're just in this holding pattern until something really addictive comes up, and which is social augmented reality.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Through glasses, I think, and also virtual reality eventually. But I think the various realities are going to be so addictive, so compelling, and so all encompassing that we're going to look back fondly at the era when people thought they were addicted to smartphones and think, whoa, those were the days. Everything was fantastic.
Remember when you could see people's eyes? Remember that?
Gee, it's too bad. It's too bad Facebook doesn't own Oculus.
Yeah.
Well,
and we are primed for this because you walk down the street, you go to a restaurant, all you see is people looking at their phones. They're not looking at each other, not talking to each other.
I
constantly amazes me. I'll go to a restaurant and there's a family sitting there and nobody's looking.
They're all on their phones.
They're all on their phones.
You know what drives me nuts? You try to ask directions when you're walking down the street of a city and you want to ask directions. Everybody's either on their phone or has headphones on. There's nobody who's actually present that you can walk up to and say, hey, how do I get to 33 and 3rd?
That feels like a pathology.
People, Larry. Don't ask me.
It's on your phone. Yeah, just check.
Go to Google Maps.
But I have to say, it's kind of an American thing, and I think to a certain extent, an Asian, Japanese, Korean, Chinese thing. Here in France, you never see anyone. I'm the only person I've ever seen wear AirPods or earbuds in public in France or Greece or any number of countries. People are not buried in their phones. In many European countries, this is not happening now.
Okay, so that's interesting because I remember sitting outside of Notre Dame in Paris 10 years ago and seeing everybody walking around looking at their phones, and I was flabbergasted. This was before.
They're all tourists. They're all visitors.
No, this was before it was happening in the U.S. Text messaging was very big in Europe before it happened.
Europe first, right.
Maybe they've just gone to – maybe that's the future because maybe they've come full circle ahead of us. Anyway, you guys are doing exactly what I was afraid of. The modern world. I hate it.
I love it.
No, you guys are great. You guys are great. I'm so glad we could get Mike Elgin here. He's visiting from France today. And he'll be going back to France right after the show. I'll be going to see the Oscars right after the show. I don't know what Larry Magid's going to be doing. He's from CBS News Radio.
I might go into San Francisco and see a play.
Yeah, be empty. It'll be what? Deserted. It's a great
That's
time
good.
To drive
yeah, I know.
Around.
That's why there's so many cheap seats.
Yeah.
Bring your phone.
What show are you going to go see?
I'm looking it up right now because I can't remember the tight name of it. Isn't that weird? It's called, I'm bringing it up right now, Born Yesterday. It looks kind of dumb, but
is
my
it based on the old Judy Holliday Born Yesterday?
Yeah, it's based on that. And my wife's in Pittsburgh right now, so I'm all alone. Hey,
perfect.
So,
perfect.
I might just go see
go
a
see
play.
A show. You really are an old man. And I'm going to go see the opera. And Dwight Silverman, who actually acts as an old man on stage in the theater, as well as writing for Tech Burger at the Houston Chronicle. Great to have all of you.
And I'm Oscar bound after this,
yeah,
too.
No, I don't know why, but I'm hooked on this whole thing. I just love the Oscars. Our show today, you know what I'll be doing? I'll be cooking up a nice meal. We just got our Blue Apron on Wednesday, and there's some delicious...
Told me that, I would have come in person.
Come to it.
You would invite
well,
me to
yeah,
it.
Blue Apron's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission, to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. When you cook with Blue Apron, you're not just having burgers for dinner. You're making short rib burgers with a hoppy cheddar sauce on a pretzel bun. Or maybe you're having what we're having tonight, seared steaks and thyme pan sauce with mashed potatoes, green beans, and crispy shallots. You made it yourself. There's nothing like the food you make yourself. But you didn't have to shop for it. You didn't have to prep it. It came perfectly ready to cook with the recipe. You get 12 recipes every week you can choose from. Pick 2, 3, or 4, depending on what fits your schedule and your needs. They have programs for couples. And actually, we usually feed the three of us on the couples program. They also have family plans for families of four with more kid-friendly ingredients. Only non-GMO ingredients and meat with no added hormones. Look at what's on the menu. Some fabulous stuff. Quick bucatini with broccoli and pecorino cheese. Pan-fried chicken breast with sweet and tangy zucchini. You'll learn new ingredients, new recipes. And once you've cooked a Blue Apron recipe, this is what I found, I can cook it again. So I'm really broadening my repertoire. Sometimes I get in a rut, and Blue Apron just kicks you right out of it. Italian-style shrimp and sweet peppers. Actually, I think this is what we're cooking. Over fragola sarda pasta. Parmesan-crusted steaks with mashed potato and broccoli. You want to try it? I've got a great deal for you. Blue Apron's treating our listeners to $30 off your first order and free shipping. All you have to do is go to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off with free shipping. blueapron.com/twit. We love Blue Apron. It's a better way to cook. And we lost Dwight Silverman. He ran out the door to get a Tech Burger, but we'll get him back. Larry Magid is here. Mike Elgin is here. Let's see. We were talking about social media and smartphones. Wall Street Journal had an interesting article, I think it was yesterday. Apparently, smartphone sales are starting to go down.
Yep.
Is it the price going up or the fact that people just don't feel like they need a new phone?
I think it's the iPad problem. I think it's the tablet problem, where phones are great. They last for a long time. The new features are
they're not compelling, are they?
They're theoretically right. amazing, yeah. but they don't allow you to yeah. do anything differently, really. Yeah. Yeah. And so right. people think, well, I'll just hang on to my phone for maybe 2 or 3 years instead of 1 or 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the improvements in the camera, which is, you know, it's interesting watching the Galaxy S9 introduction. It was all about the camera, and undoubtedly it's a much better camera. But there's a limit. I mean, it's not the limit. It's like people are already pretty happy with their phone, pretty happy with the cameras in their phones. And to go out and spend close to $1,000, which is what one of these premium phones costs, even, you know, Apple's the only one that actually got above $1,000, but they all approach that price. That's a big ticket item. It's like buying a new refrigerator. And why would you buy a new refrigerator
if your old one's
still working?
Yeah.
Right. I haven't bought a refrigerator
so much,
in years.
Yeah. No.
And there's so much else to buy. There are drones. There are like cameras. There are home automation things. Like, you know, the consumer electronics dollar
I buy a new drone every month.
Who doesn't?
Doesn't crash it every month. No, I've finally sworn off drones. I have finally crashed my last drone. I'm not buying any more drones. I did buy the S9, but I'm different because I have to review it.
Right.
It's interesting. DxOMark gave it its highest score ever. But because everybody looks at the top level number at DxO, Mark, 99, which bests the iPhone 10 and the Google Pixel 2 XL. But if you break it down, for instance, if you look at, and this is what I find very interesting. If you look at stills, the Pixel 2 XL is better. If you look at low light performance, the iPhone 10 might be better. It's a mixed bag. There isn't really a best phone anymore. You can't just use
they
that.
They all look good.
They're all very good. And that's the point. Frankly, your Galaxy S6 is very good. Your iPhone 7 is very good. And so I think you're right. I think there's...
The only thing that they haven't broken through is killer battery life. When I get a phone that says it's going to work for 5 days on a single charge, that'll get my attention.
You know, but Motorola, the Moto X Play was really amazing battery life. And I don't notice it sold particularly well. I'm not... convinced that that's really what people want.
Well, all other things have to be equal as well.
Right.
Duracell so what, is actually what's, coming what's out interesting with about last for
this,
days.
The decline
hold on,
in this.
Hold on, Dwight. Mike just said something that can't be true. Say that again.
Yeah, Duracell is coming out with a phone that has a 16,000 milliamp hour battery.
They weigh 50 pounds.
That's four times the Note 8.
Energizer.
Energizer. Yeah,
it's gigantic. But the battery life is supposed to be like 5 or 6 days.
So this will be the test of whether people, phone. I'm with you. Just like you, I always say, if they'd only come out with a better battery. But I suspect that's not really driving. So if Energizer can sell this phone.
By this product.
Yeah.
It also has to be, you have to be able to carry it. I mean, is it portable or do you need a wheelbarrow?
Yeah, that's going
to
be pretty heavy.
The irony of the drop in sales of this and, you know, the decline of the market comes at a time when you no longer have the plans that are 2 years with subsidized pricing. Mm-hmm. People aren't spending as much. And I hear people complaining about the price, but ultimately most people aren't buying it outright. You know, Apple and AT&T and Verizon all have their next plans that don't charge interest. So you're paying it per month. And when you quit paying for it, the hardware cost goes away, which was not the case with the subsidized things. And in theory, with the Apple plan, you could walk in every year and hand them your old phone and get the new phone, and you could have a new phone every year. And if you don't go up in tiers so that, you know, you're getting a fancier phone or one with more memory, the cost will be about the same per month. It's like leasing the phone. And I'm kind of surprised that hasn't offset some of these sales, because again, you could have, if you care, you could have the latest phone every year and it's not going to hurt your pocketbook that much.
I'm surprised more people don't do that, actually. I don't do it. If anybody should do it, I should.
But you know, the other way to do it is to buy your own new phone and then sell your old phone.
Right.
And I haven't done the math to compare. And it's easy to do that. You go to Gazelle.
Yeah, we Gazelle.
They don't give you a lot, but they give you something.
Yeah, no, that's what we do. We Gazelle them. If you're ambitious, you can go to eBay and sell it yourself. Right. That's a little more work, and you probably get a little more money. But yeah, that kind of subsidizes it. And I guess the reason I don't do the long-term lease is I'm worried about breaking the phone or damaging the phone. Plus, there are family members who get my hand-me-downs. Actually, there's also employees who get my hand-me-downs. Mm-hmm. So there's a ready market for the used handsets. And I have a lot. I get probably 4 or 5 used handsets a year because I'm trying all the phones. DisplayMate like the S9, they said it's the closest thing to a perfect screen they've ever seen. They said it's better than any other screen, including your 4K HDR screen. They raved over the S9.
How does the average person tell the difference between yesterday's best screen in history and today's?
I mean, you're absolutely right.
They all look fantastic. All high-end phones in the last 2 or 3 years look absolutely breathtaking.
So Hewlett-Packard loaned me 2 laptops that were identical, except for one had an ultra high definition display and the other one had a full definition display. And the only negative side is that the ultra definition was more expensive and didn't get as much battery life.
Yeah.
Now, when I look at them together, right side by side, I can tell the difference. But the moment I put away the ultra high def and walk around and look at the one with the regular one, it looks terrific to me. I don't even care. I watch movies on it. And even when I was testing both of them, I didn't even bother walking across the room to get the ultra high definition. It just didn't add up to anything that really increased my appreciation of whatever I was watching. So I agree. I think that you know, and again, I'm sounding like an old fogey here, almost like a Luddite, but I do think that it's almost like Adam Osborne's infamous statement, sometimes adequacy is sufficient,
right?
That having the best and the greatest isn't necessarily something that everybody's going to appreciate.
Actually, I think you sound not like an old fogey, but like a real person. I think one of the hazards of being a tech journalist is we are so enamored of the new.
Right. We get all the stuff to play with. Yeah.
That we forget that normal people are not, you know, they're buying refurbed phones. They're buying, you know, in this Wall Street Journal article, they quote somebody saying it's like a Mercedes. I want a Mercedes, but I'm not going to buy the brand new Mercedes off the lot. I'm going to wait a couple of years and buy it used. And then I'll be driving a Mercedes. It'll just be 2 years old Mercedes. They think that that's what's happening with
except
phones.
For I think. But the irony is in cars, and this is a whole other program, that actually is where the innovation is taking place. And I'm thinking the next time I get a car, I might lease it because unlike the past, I used to keep my cars for 10 years. But now, 10 years from now, today's cars are going to seem really
exactly
old-fashioned.
Right. Lisa wouldn't let me buy this Tesla outright because she's – and she was right, by the way, shortly after I took delivery of the Model 10 – the Model X, I'm sorry. Wait a minute, it's iPhone 10 and Model X. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Of the Model X.
They came out
with a completely new platform, and my car was obsolete literally a month after I took delivery.
But if you lease it, you're
but fortunately you released it. Yeah. And so right. I'll then, you know, begin. So this is the kind of ad copy that a company would drool over from DisplayMate. This Galaxy S9 display performance sets many new display performance records, including absolute color accuracy that is visually indistinguishable from perfect and almost certainly considerably better than your existing smartphone, your living room 4K Ultra HD TV, your tablet, your laptop, and computer monitor. In other words, it's their highest ever A-plus grade. And you're exactly right, Mike. Everybody goes, hey, that's really cool. And what's wrong with this one? Or actually,
and when they come out with the next one, what are they going to tell us about the screen then? Oh, one was
perfecter
terrible.
Than
this
perfect.
Perfecter.
but I, for one of the reasons I got into this business is so because I do want to see what they mean, and I want that phone because then I could say this is the perfectest display ever made. It's perfecter.
Yeah.
That's just my particular.
It sounds like Donald Trump is writing the ad copy.
It's perfecter.
Here.
It's even better than perfect.
Believe me.
One disappointment in tech. A good article came out today in Motherboard and part of Vice. Motherboard does great work. Carl Bode writing. 8 years later, Google Fiber, a faint echo of the disruption we were promised. Here's an example of something that we thought 8 years ago was going to change the way we got internet. And it turns out that, you know, Google's pretty much backed off. They went through several CEOs. The CEO now comes from the cable industry. They've stopped expanding. They've stopped adding cities. There are fewer than 100,000 subscribers to Google Fiber TV, which is the TV service riding on top of this. Part of it, though, you can blame on the current incumbents who have so much clout, as we know, in Congress and state legislatures. They were able to keep Google from using their utility poles. They were locked out.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say because the current incumbents are also offering, in some cases, gigabit internet.
They're doing
and that brings up the same issue we were talking about display. So I don't have gigabit internet. I have 200 megabit internet.
You have plenty.
And that's the thing. I have plenty. And it's funny because I've been thinking about I'm on Comcast now, and I'm thinking I could save money by going to AT&T, which only offers 50 megabit. And there's something inside of me that says, no, there's no way I'm going to cut my performance by 75%. But the reality is that if I did go to 50 megabit, it would still be adequate for my needs. And I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, but you don't have three teenagers in your basement all watching YouTube, Netflix, and, you know, you don't have – there are households –
not simultaneously, no.
Yeah, there are plenty of households where there are four or five heavy users all, you know, at once.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's common in our house. There's only three of us, but we're watching – probably three HD streams
and we are too. And with our 200 is way more, you know, it works per, I don't know whether 50 would be adequate for that, but
50 might
we
not.
Have plenty of bandwidth without the gigabit.
So
even though if gigabit were available, I'd probably get it. It just happens.
Of course you would. You'd be crazy. We have 10 gigabits down and up here. We can't use that. There's no machine in the building that can use more than a gigabit, but I got
it. You have it. You have it. So I think this article article touches on this, but I take issue with the premise of it. I think Google Fiber was very disruptive, mainly because I don't think we would be at 1 gigabit with Comcast and AT&T they hadn't done it. I know that when they came into Austin, it completely tore up the market there, and AT&T quickly rushed in and did 1 gigabit. And they even offered it here in Houston out of fear that Google Fiber might come here. So even though they didn't show up here, just the possibility that Google Fiber would come in, AT&T and Comcast both now offer gigabit services. And I think that you can thank Google Fiber for that.
But I think, you know, so Austin was always going to have fantastic internet connectivity. I think the failure comes from the idea that I think deep down we kind of hoped that the rural areas in the United States would sort of leapfrog, go from horrible to wonderful. But in fact, that never happened. So
that's
kind of the rich got richer in terms of bandwidth.
Well, and if you want a positive spin on it, it could very well be that everybody's waiting. Google's certainly waiting to see what 5G offers. And that will help rural areas. Wireless is always good for rural areas. You don't have to trench. You don't have to put anything on poles. You could just beam it into the area.
Do you think that 5G will actually take the place of wired internet? Do you think that a significant number of people will use 5G at home instead of their wired broadband?
Mm-mm. No.
You don't?
Your question has there's two answers. The first answer is, what is 5G and when the hell is it going to happen? And is it going to happen as they promised? Remember what they promised with LTE. Remember what they promised with 3G. Remember what they... If 5G lives up to its promise, one of the promises of 5G is that you would essentially be using a wireless connection that's as fast as a local hard drive.
Exactly.
Which would totally change your thinking. I just ordered the first Windows on ARM laptop from HP. It should be coming in a couple of weeks. It's overpriced. It's the HP Envy X2. It's $1,000. But it has a Qualcomm gigabit chip in it. It has LTE. It's a pound and a half. It has 120 gigs of storage. It doesn't have much storage, but it has 22-hour battery life, they claim. And that's one of the reasons I bought it, to see if it does. That is interesting, not maybe so much now, but what if 5G comes along and now suddenly you're, no matter where you are, operating at full speed with a total connection. That could be changing, life-changing, but I don't know if it's going to happen. 5G is just a marketing term.
Well, it also depends on pricing and whether they're going to charge you whether they're going to charge you for data and how much. I mean, that could have a huge impact
in the chat room. Twisted Mister says that HP, that Windows on ARM HP is going to cost you an arm and a leg. It is $999, which is a little pricey for 4 gigs of RAM and 128.
On the other hand, it's cheaper than my laptop, and it's a heck of a lot lighter.
There's two things. It's really light. It's really portable. It comes with a pen. It comes with a keypad. So $1,000 is maybe not as horrible as it sounds. But the main reason I'm getting it, I want to see what the battery life is, and I want to see if it's usable. A Snapdragon 835, is that as usable as, say, an Intel Core M processor? Is it more? Is it less? I plan to bring this one to Japan with me. This will be my travel laptop.
And the small hard drive or the small SSD seems like a deficit, but actually you don't need to have all of your data with you all of the time.
You're always
more than enough.
Yeah.
It's more than enough for your software and your operating system and whatever data you're working with.
Well, it has a micro SD card slot, so I'm going to put it on 28.
You can add then.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'll put another drive.
So I don't think that 5G is going to be the savior for rural users. I think you still have to get the infrastructure. You have to put the transmitters out there. They won't put the transmitters out there unless they think they have an economic incentive to do so. There'll be enough people who will buy it. And there's the issue of getting the backhaul to match
that's
hard drive speed.
Yep. Yep.
And so it's the same promises as made before, but unless the economics are there, it's not going to get into the rural areas.
But it does solve the last mile problem. It does solve that problem of actually having to run a wire to your house, which in theory...
Well, LTE was supposed to solve that too, and it did not.
And WiMAX was... I remember how excited we were about WiMAX. Right. Suddenly, this is going to wire the rural areas. Now, WiMAX did have one advantage. It worked over long distances. I don't know whether micromillimeter will. I suspect it won't, and I think that's going to be a problem with 5G, but... I don't know enough about it. It's such a soft definition. It really is going to depend on how or what gets implemented over the next couple of years. Let's take a break. Mike Elgin, what are you drinking tonight? Anything delicious?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We had dinner with friends, and we opened a 1985 bottle of Bordeaux that was
you.
Out of this world.
I hate you.
I hate myself,
Leo. Oh, man, I'm so jealous. Oh, God. Bordeaux is my weakness, I have to say.
And yes.
Man, is that,
kryptonite.
Is that good? It's my kryptonite, absolutely. I'm so jealous. Although, Mike, when he came back from Georgia, and I don't mean Atlanta, I mean Tbilisi, Georgia, brought me a bottle of Georgian wine that was really good. It was very drinkable.
You liked
it. No 1985 Bordeaux, but it was really good. Yeah. I liked it a lot. Okay. Well,
good.
I'm glad you don't have anything else in front of you because it's getting to be that hour. I don't want you falling asleep. Also with us, Larry Maggott. He's a little closer to home from in the San Francisco Bay Area. He is on CBS News Radio Nationwide. ConnectSafely.org is his website. To help kids be online safely. He's
Thank
an
you.
Expert. And from Tech Burger himself, from the Houston Chronicle, our good dear friend, Dwight Silverman. I love doing shows with my old friends like you guys talking about this stuff because I really think that we get it. You kids, you don't get it. We get it.
You know, it's also fun when we're on with younger folks as well because occasionally
like
you do mix up the generations.
Yeah. No,
but I remember one time when Jerry Purnell was on with me, and I can't remember who else, but again,
probably
it was
Dvorak.
Like,
it was probably Dvorak.
Yeah, the average Purnell age was like 90 or something.
Yeah. Like, I have to say, I'm very sad Jerry passed away. I really miss Jerry. He was quite the character. We didn't always agree, but he was quite the character.
I was such a fan of his science fiction that first time I was on with him, it was like, I'm on with Larry Purnell. I can't talk.
I found the other day, I have to see if I can. So Jerry Purnell was playing, was it the Simpsons game or We Rule? I think it might have been We Rule, one of those farming games. And I was playing, we were playing together. And in this game, the mechanics of the game, he gave me a book. And it said on my screen, Jerry Purnell just gave you a book. And I snapped that when I saved that one. That's my claim to fame. I played
That's
a game
honor.
With Jerry Purnell. Our show today brought to you by Quicken Loans, the folks who have really swept the nation. Number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row. If there were an Oscar for customer satisfaction, they would win it. That's in mortgage approval and mortgage servicing, 4 years in a row, number one in customer satisfaction. But even with all those awards, they could have rested on their laurels. But even with all those awards, they said there's something wrong with the mortgage business. This loan approval process is not working for us. You go to a bank, you fill out a 20-page application. Then you go home and you got to go through find pay stubs and bank statements. And they keep coming back and asking for more. And it just is, it's old-fashioned. It's inefficient. They created a technological, client-focused service for a loan approval that is fantastic. It makes me want to buy a house just to use it. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. And, you know, we've had our house now for 4 years. We bought it. And 4 years ago, we went to the bank. We did that whole thing. It was awful. It took a month. They kept coming back and asking for more. Rocket Mortgage, not months, not weeks, not days, it's minutes. Here's what you do. You go to Quicken Loans website for Rocket Mortgage, which is actually used to be Quicken Loans. It's now rocketmortgage.com/twit2. You go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. You answer a few simple questions you already know. There's no 20-page application. They have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions. So all you do is you share your information with them at the touch of a button. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credit. They'll analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's right for you. You choose the term, the down payment, the rate. You get the loan you want, and it takes minutes. Minutes! And it's so nice when that big green button that says you're approved. You could do this at an open house, show the realtor, and make an offer there on the spot. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. That's rocketmortgage.com, twit and the number 2. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumerAccess.org, number 30. We thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. I think we have a what Dvorak used to call a house ad, a promo for some of the things you might have missed this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
As you know, I'm very into creating a charging station. Michael tweeted out a picture of his charging station monitor.
Wow, he either has a super big iPhone.
Yeah.
They look like my Dr. Evil chair.
Aren't they adorable?
Triangulation.
I have the distinct honor of welcoming a true geek, someone who you've probably seen if you've run in the sci-fi and fantasy circles. It's Mr. David Hewlett.
I think before I actually realized you could be an actor, I wanted to be a Time Lord. The amount of time I spent trying to build a sonic screwdriver is embarrassing, you know? Because it just seems so logical to me.
All about Android.
If I was on a Galaxy S7, I'd even have problems justifying the purchase price, like, because the camera on something like the S7 was just fantastic. So in that sort of respect, there's no real reason to go for it. And there are certainly people out there that are still rocking in a Galaxy S4 and a Galaxy S5. To those people, I say the S9 is definitely worth it.
Security Now.
All of the evidence suggests that Cellebrite may now be able to unlock from iPhone 5 through iPhone 10.
Twit. Say hello to the NSA. They're listening.
Jason, we got Leo's Tesla in front of us.
We turned into giants. That's what really happened.
Okay, so this is enough.
Oh, I don't even want to know what they did to that. Did they mess with that on know-how? Let's talk about this story. This is comes from Forbes, but I think it's reported elsewhere as well. Cellebrite, which is the Israeli company that's widely believed to be the company that broke the San Bernardino iPhone, the one the feds begged Apple to unlock and then said, never mind, I think we got this. They have announced, it's probably good marketing, that they can even get into the iPhone 10, any model of iPhone up to iOS 11.2.6. So this is exclusive to Forbes. This is something that they've discovered recently. Generally, these require vulnerabilities in the iOS operating system, and that's something of a concern. And these companies are holding on to these exploits. They're not telling consumers because then they can sell their services to law enforcement, not just in this country, but all over the world. And so we don't get the security update, and they get to spy on us.
And we don't know who else is spying on us. We if it's possible to crack these iPhones, then is the NSA doing it? Are the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, et cetera, doing it? Are the nefarious criminal hackers doing it? There's no way to know until much, much later when we find out after it's long too late. But the question is whether, you know, this is something that's, you know, sometimes there's a theoretical possibility of being able to exploit something. And then there's something that's genuinely exploitable in some sort of practical way. So it's early days on this particular one. But we'll see if, we'll see what Steve says about this.
And does this require physical access to the phone, or is it something you can do remotely? Because there's a huge difference when they actually have to have your phone.
Here's what Cellebrite told Forbes. Quote, with its service offering, Cellebrite can retrieve, without needing to root or jailbreak the device, the full file system to recover downloaded emails, third-party application data, geolocation data, and system logs. Agencies can provide the device already unlocked, furnish the known passcode or code, or use Cellebrite's advanced unlocking services to unlock the device. So they do need physical access.
Physical access.
Once the device is unlocked and or extracted, it is returned to the originating agency. Any extracted data is also sent to the agency. Oh, here's the good news. In encrypted form to ensure privacy. Fantastic. Well, thank goodness. Of course, they're not telling anybody how they do it, and that's my big problem with this, is that there is now a strong... I mean, they have million-dollar contracts with law enforcement.
It gets Apple off the hook. I mean, in a way.
It may be what... who knows? You know, for all we know, Apple's telling them, hey, by the way.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, it just makes me mad, that's all. just makes me mad. You know, I had a call. This is something maybe you guys want to address. I had a call today from a young woman who had a gaming machine, and it was an older machine that she'd built with an Asus motherboard that was a few years old, and it had not been patched for Spectre and Meltdown. And she said, I can't get a motherboard update from Asus, so it won't be patched, so I'm not using it.
Mm.
And I said, oh, my goodness, use it.
Right.
I don't. Yeah. Have we oversold some of these security flaws?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I have a new machine which has a BIOS update, and I'm not applying the BIOS update for fear that it might patch Spectre, because I'm a little nervous about what that's going to do to my system.
If it's performance
slow it down,
yeah,
they're going to, you know, the bug. So I actually think that in some cases the cure is worse than the disease. I mean, yes, there is a risk, but with all the risks that are out there, I'm not convinced that the Spectre risk is as ominous as some people fear it is, and I'm actually more worried about my machine not working properly if I apply the patch.
Well, and there are fixes at the operating system and at the browser level.
That's
so
what I told
even
her.
If she doesn't
That's
have,
exactly yeah, what I told yeah. her, yeah. So she's missing one part of the overall patch. The risk is low. I told her, just do what we've always told you to do. Keep your system up to date. Don't download software from strangers. Don't run programs you didn't specifically go out to get. And my new advice, which I am really pushing, is install as few programs as you can in general on any device. Mm. We all do this. I have hundreds of apps on my phone, most of which I will never use. Everything you put on your computer, whether it's a phone, a tablet, or a desktop, potentially opens exploits, opens holes, affects reliability. It doesn't just waste space. It could be a security flaw. Don't install it.
And if it's a mobile, it also affects the battery operation, or it could.
Yeah, and location information. I think there's a lot of companies. I'm starting to see this. I believe there are a lot of companies out there who are actually pushing dopey iPhone and Android applications just to get on your phone, because there's so much value in the data they glean from just sitting on your phone that they're just desperate to get on your phone.
Right.
Yeah. By the same token, I think back to your original question, there's a huge mismatch between the threat of certain things that could happen and the energy
coverage
behind it. So you go to a lot of websites and they insist on this ridiculous password, and the thing that they're protecting is nothing. It's worthless.
Right.
It's there's no data, there's no nothing. It's like, you know, so it's very important to realize that security threats will be with us forever, and they will always but you have to remember, what is the threat? What could happen? And if the worst thing that could happen is that somebody reads your subscription to the Wall Street Journal, then you don't need Fort Knox security to secure that account.
Right. My Wall Street Journal password is a lot less secure than my banking password for that reason. I mean, and the other thing is, you know, this is an issue in the internet safety field also, is understanding the difference between prevalence and severity. Sometimes these very, very severe threats, whether you're talking about, you know, kids being abducted or machines being taken over and manipulated, are horrible, but statistically unlikely to happen. So often we worry about the wrong threats. And so it's really important to kind of think through before you take any extraordinary effort to protect yourself. A, what is the likelihood of it happening to you? And two, what are the consequences of it happening? And often the things that are the most severe are the least likely, but the things that are less severe but still extremely annoying are most likely. So
are consumers, are normal people equipped to judge the risks? I mean, I think the burden is on us.
On experts, exactly.
To be, you know, there's so much temptation to oversell the threat. Again, link bait. Really, I think it's incumbent on tech journalists who have the knowledge to share that information and say what the risks are.
Right.
And I'm guilty of this. I mean, this poor woman was terrified, probably because I'd been talking for weeks about Spectre Meltdown.
And for security companies not to oversell the danger, because obviously I can see why it meets their marketing fee. But this is a problem, and this isn't recent, but there was a time when McAfee would everything was incredibly, the world's falling apart. If you don't install our software, you know, you're going to die in a matter of minutes. And it got to the point where I stopped recommending their software. Their software is actually pretty good. But their marketing was so fear-mongering that I thought they were doing more harm than good. They've gotten better since Intel bought them. So these are old critiques.
Yeah, but you're right. You're absolutely right, Larry. You have to have a sense of probability. That's why I always fly with a bomb, because the chances there to be two bombs on a plane are infinitesimal.
Okay, he's making that
you
up.
Used to fly.
You're on the watch list.
Don't fly anymore.
By the way, Intel sold McAfee last year, didn't they?
Well, they sold it.
They spun it out, and it was Intel Security. They've rebranded it because the McAfee brand is such a strong brand.
Especially the man himself.
Yes. Why they renamed it? I guess because it's not Intel anymore. They renamed it McAfee. Wow. Real quickly, actually, let's take a break, and then I want to talk about Amazon, because there's a lot of Amazon in the news, including a big purchase. And the fact that Amazon paid zero taxes last year, zero U.S. income taxes. Did they make any money? I think they did. Our show today brought to you by My Mattress. I tell you, the more I learn about health, the more I realize that how you sleep is maybe one of the most important things for your health. It's not just about whether you feel rested in the morning. It literally affects illness, everything. And having a comfortable mattress that sleeps cool, that helps you get a good night's sleep, is so important. I sleep on a Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. They revolutionized, I think this is safe to say, they completely transformed the mattress industry. They saw a real problem in the mattress industry. Massive markups and middlemen, mattress stores that weren't doing people any good. And they said, you know, if we sell direct, if we eliminate the costs of resellers and showrooms and we sell direct to customers, not only can we cut the cost, but we can give customers a better experience. So what they did is they made a great mattress. They sell it directly to you. And you, by the way, free shipping and free returns if you don't like it in the U.S. and in Canada and in the U.K. You sleep on this mattress and they give you 100 nights. You get 100 nights. So you can try it. You can see, really, if this mattress works for you. And if at any time in that first 100 nights you don't like it, you call them. They come and get it, and they refund you every penny. So there's absolutely no risk. This is a better way. This is the revolution. There are a lot of copycats, but Casper is the original. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a sleep surface. Go look at the website. With just the right sink, just the right bounce. Its breathable design means you sleep cool. And even in the winter, that's important. You know, you got the heat on and everything. You don't want to be hot in bed. You want to sleep cool. And they don't say this in their ad copy, but I'm going to say this. I've had mattresses I've had to air out for weeks. They just smelled funny, like the factory. The Casper mattress, it came out of the box, and it's a surprisingly small box. It goes, opens up. I didn't have to air it out at all. It smelled fabulous. It's comfortable. Casper is amazing. The highest environmental production standards. They're made in the USA, and you can get a Casper mattress right now and save $50 on select mattresses when you go to casper.com/twit. casper.com/twit. Use the promo code at checkout for $50 off select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Casper is casper.com/twit with the promo code twit to save $50.
One of these days is a publicity stunt. Leo, you should do the entire show from bed.
I will. Like John and Yoko.
Oh, yeah, we could all get in
Lisa
bed.
And Leo will all be.
King size bed that would fit the entire, all the guests.
We have a Casper King, and it's pretty spacious. It really, we could all four fit in that.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Do it. We can sing. We can sing Everybody's Talking About Techism.
A little John Lennon reference there for you. That's kids. Right. Amazon earned billions in 2017, paid no U.S. taxes, according to CNN Money. Not only is Jeff Bezos the richest person of all time, but he made $5 billion his company made $5 billion in 2017, no taxes. Not illegal. Not illegal. This is just more of that, you know.
If Donald Trump would say smart.
Smart.
Right.
They actually paid taxes in previous years, but at a what's your tax rate? My tax rate is close to 40, maybe 50%. They paid at 11.4%, even though they had profits of $8.2 billion. Anyway, I don't want to set up. I don't want to set people up for jealousy, but it's there's amazing what you can do with money like that. Like, for instance, buy Ring, and that's what they did this week. We don't know exactly how much. Initially, we thought it was $1 billion. Now I'm seeing from Recode numbers closer to 1.2 to 1.4 billion dollars. Now, Ring is a sponsor. We should mention we do Ring ads all the time. I take some responsibility for Ring's success. I will get zero of this money, but I'm happy for Jamie and his team because that's really nice. Here's the question. Why?
Amazon Key.
Well, but they already have Key, right? They tried. Remember, they tried to buy August.
Yeah.
That fell through. In fact, August was pretty pissed off. They feel like that Amazon found out how everything worked right. And said, okay, well, never mind. And they built shortly thereafter, they built the Key system, which allows an Amazon delivery person.
This expands on that.
Into though. Your house. There's a camera. There's a lock. They can open the lock. The camera watches them while they put the package in the door and they leave. Is that available in Houston? Have you tried it?
Yes, it is available. I have not tried it. I know somebody who has it, and they love it. We have a real problem in Houston, as in a lot of other places,
right,
with people stealing packages. Houston is the place, I think it is, where the guy invented the box where you pick it up and a shotgun shell goes off in the box and scares the person. Yes.
Only in Texas, my friend. And yeah, Florida really. And some states.
But that is a it's such an issue here that the guy loves it. You know, he doesn't mind at all. And I just could not do that. There's just no way I would allow that.
And what
I couldn't
seen
do
hacks.
My dog would bite the guy. So yeah, that would be a problem.
Well, then my other problem is that it's Amazon Logistics, which I don't know what it's like in Houston, but in Amazon Logistics in Petaluma is some person
awful.
That you not in a uniform in a normal car, because they kind of do it like Uber. Where they list deliveries that they have, and somebody says, okay, I'll do those. And so, to me, that's like somebody, like just somebody off the street coming in my house.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have the problem with packages getting stolen, because I have a Ring video doorbell. So, right. So maybe that's the, I don't know. So is that why they bought it? They want to replace Key with Ring?
Or expand those reason. Services.
Or have
oh, I think it ties in. I think it ties in with the whole ecosystem for both. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when you look at Amazon, Google, and Apple are all competing to own your home and have as many devices in your home as possible. And I think it ties in with the Echo. And I'm sure that they will continue to find ways to integrate it. I suspect they're already integrated to some extent. But it's Amazon really having a robust offering of home devices, and I think they're going to have more of them.
Does Ring do anything other than a doorbell?
They have lights. A doorbell for the front door, and then they attach the doorbell to lights, so it has
security lights, yeah.
Kind of the same thing. But they did remember this; they were going to launch last Christmas a home security system, and ADT sued them. And I think that lawsuit's over. In fact, my understanding is, shortly before Amazon bought them, Ring settled for a larger amount than they were agreed. You know, they suddenly said, okay, here's $25 million. And the ADT suit went away. So they have now on their page, they are selling their home security system.
Are they currently integrated to Alexa in any way?
Yes, totally.
Yeah, that's what I figured they would be.
Yeah. So everything, that actually.
Everything is. Course,
everything
yeah.
is. That doesn't give right. them an exclusive by any means.
No. No, but it means that they can add value.
Theory. Yeah. So Amazon is famous for a number of things. And one of them is having a kind of quasi Orwellian employee situation where they watch their employees.
Oh, wow.
In a microcosmic way. Everyone's clocked in. They monitor their location. And they're about to launch inevitably into this world where Amazon employees will be doing the lion's share of deliveries to the front door.
Yes.
And this is a way for them to monitor their own employees and their performance and their behavior.
Interesting.
Wow.
But you have to have so many of those Rings installed. Not everybody's going to put those in there. That doesn't make sense in that sense.
The privacy. So if I have a Ring in my house, does Amazon have the right to look at the video
okay.
that my Ring is recording?
This is something that I've been kind of pursuing recently. I've asked Amazon several times pointed questions about exactly what they do in terms of, do they listen when they're not listening to the keywords, and are they doing experiments where they have Alexa doing things that people don't necessarily expect? And whenever I ask those questions, they just stop interacting with me. They don't answer them. And that doesn't mean that they're doing those things. It doesn't mean anything nefarious, but it does mean that they have not answered those questions yet.
That's
so
odd.
I've read their terms of service. There's nothing in the terms of service that I can find that prohibits them from monitoring video feeds, listening in through Amazon, doing any of these things. And I think it's an underexplored area. We have this black box that we're putting in every house. And I'm not a conspiracy theory minded person or suspicious of tech companies as a rule. But in this case, I'm a little concerned about Amazon because they hold it so close to the vest. They don't tell us exactly what they're doing. They have a history of, for example, with the Fire Phone, of when you take a picture of something, they're also transmitting the audio back to Amazon and doing God knows what with it. So I don't think they've earned our trust yet. They're not transparent enough yet. And I think that it behooves those of us in the media to keep pushing them to find out exactly what their intentions are, what they do, what they don't do. And it's especially urgent now that they have all these Ring video doorbells.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because my Echo will sometimes talk to me even though I don't say the word.
Oh, that happens all the time. It's because it's like you're watching TV, yeah, right?
Or it's right. Or hear something else and thinks you're saying the word.
So does my Google Home, though.
I apologize for saying that word on your show because I'm sure that millions of Echoes just got activated when I said it. So.
You know what? You know, it's only a problem if you're listening to the show on your Echo because then it stops the show and says, what do you want? And so that's a little annoying. But other than that, these things happen. We actually bloop it out of the downloaded version. So it's only people watching live that get bit by that. But isn't that something we've decided to start doing, we bloop it out.
And here's a weird thing that may surprise some of your listeners. Yeah. But I actually travel with both my Echo and also my Ring video doorbell. I travel with both of these. Two of the most important things that I travel with. Yeah, everywhere we go, we plug in the Echo. We have music, we have information, weather reports.
So you're not so worried about the privacy implications that you don't use it?
No.
How do you hook up a doorbell? Are you renting a place or are you in a hotel? Where are you that you can hook up a doorbell?
I use mounting putty and I put it outside the door. I connect it to the Wi-Fi and everywhere I go.
It's got a one-year battery in it, some of them.
Oh, yeah.
And so you don't have to worry about powering it. You could
I'm going to find out where he's staying and go steal his doorbell.
Yeah.
You're wrong with mounting putty.
Yeah.
That's right. You have to pull hard.
That's really interesting, Mike. I know you thought it was a good product for Airbnb renters.
Everyone involved in renting Airbnb should be using this. Yeah. It's just a fantastic. So the biggest thing. So we've stayed in a lot of countries that are not necessarily safe. And when you're in an Airbnb, everyone in the neighborhood knows you're a foreigner with expensive equipment and all this stuff. And so it's kind of a little bit, you get kind of nervous. And with a Ring video doorbell, you come back to the house. Before you go in, you check to see if anyone has gone in.
Right.
And you can see, oh, nobody's gone in, and you walk in with confidence.
Oh, that's really nice. That's a great reason to do that.
I don't have a Ring, but I have a Vivid system. And so if somebody comes to my door, I'll get a notice saying somebody's at your door. But by the time I get to look at them, they're usually gone because of the delay. Do you find that you actually can often see the person in real time and interact with them before they actually leave?
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's all the time.
It's instantaneous almost.
Maybe mine has worse latency.
There's about 10 seconds, 5 to 10 seconds latency in worst case. But that's enough usually to catch the people wait at the door. But they ring the doorbell, they wait 10 seconds.
Yeah, no, my latency I think is about 30 seconds. So that's good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they've done it right, and I mean, that's why Amazon bought them. But, you know, Amazon doesn't need to push the envelope. They're doing great. they don't have to take chances with people's privacy. They don't even have to make acquisitions of cameras if that makes people nervous. Now, I'm not a CEO, and I never will be, so I don't maybe understand business. But why would Jeff Bezos take chances like that?
Their whole business model is based on algorithmically determined sort of behavioral model. So they if you think about what they track and what they do on the Amazon website, and even when you go beyond the website, whether they go where you, they figure out where you're going, what you're doing, how long the mouse hovers over this. Does that mean you're interested? They're upset, and look at their grocery store, Amazon Go. This is not about a convenient grocery store. This is about a physical brick and mortar grocery store that has the kind of behavioral data that their website has. And so they're obsessed with understanding what people do. And a camera is by far the most valuable sensor for figuring out what's happening in general with human behavior. They can see who's coming, who's going, what time, how long, you know, all this stuff that's happening. And so it's all, they're like Google. It's all about the data. It's about big data and how you can plug in artificial intelligence to get information that enables you to be more competitive in everything you do.
10 years from now,
I suppose they're going to take pictures of your grocery bags as you walk in the house and figure out where you're buying your groceries and make sure that they're underbidding.
Wow.
You know, yeah, maybe.
Wow, that's interesting. 10 years from now, we're going to look back and regret that we didn't weren't more proactive in fighting the growth of Amazon and Google and Facebook.
Are we?
Do you think so?
You know,
I don't know.
I don't think so. I think things change and happen so quickly that Google and Facebook and Amazon in 10 years may not be what they are now, and there may be somebody else we have to worry about fighting.
Okay.
It just, you know, it's funny you say that, because all the time.
I remember during the antitrust case against Microsoft, and I was I kind of sympathized with the Justice Department at the time. But Bill Gates made a statement in front of the Senate. He said, you know, it could very well be that some company comes along and they wind up taking a big part of our business. And of course, he didn't at the time know that Google was about to eat his lunch when it came to the internet. And you know, it turned out to be true. Not that Microsoft failed as a company. It's doing fine. But certainly in the area that we were all worried about in the late 90s, which was their Internet Explorer and what they were going to do online, it turned out that they didn't dominate. This other company came around and dominated. And maybe it's fortunate that our legal system wasn't able to do what it tried to do, because it turns out that market forces were even better.
Well, but there was an article last Sunday in the Times, Charles Duhigg writing about Google, said Google wouldn't exist if the DOJ hadn't gone after Microsoft. Not so much because Microsoft shut Google, DOJ shut Microsoft down, but just that Microsoft got cautious. They started looking over their shoulders,
and that
was enough to open the door for Google. Otherwise, Microsoft might have persisted with Explorer and Bing.
But Google had better products. I mean,
won in the marketplace. I agree.
They had a great early search engine, way back.
And now I think Google's getting cautious because of all of the antitrust stuff in Europe and so on.
Sure.
You can feel the wind being taken out of their sails. They seem less aggressive, much more cautious about getting into things that involve privacy and so on. So I think the same thing is happening to them. I guess you reach a certain size and you just can't be as scrappy and aggressive as you were when you were a startup.
You know, the GDPR, which is this global data privacy thing out of Europe, general privacy thing out of Europe, is kicking in, I think, in May. And that's going to have a huge impact on all these companies. I don't know if you've done a show about that.
We've talked a lot about it, absolutely.
It's a huge issue.
You know, there's a real division among our panelists about whether this is going to be a disaster for the internet or something much needed for the internet. And I'm go back and forth, but I'm starting to kind of head over on the, we do need some protections. And since the U.S. seems to not want to do this, it's good at least that Europe's paying attention to this. I'm not sure I agree with all of the legal action.
No, you got it right. Europe doesn't always get it right, but they're well intentioned, and at least they are.
Somebody's got to pay attention to this, because the FTC sure as heck isn't,
and the FCC, of course, isn't.
And then there's always the argument. Well, and I think Dwight, you were kind of making this stuff changes so fast. Innovation will win. You don't have to worry. Technology, the business cycle is so rapid that you just let it happen.
Look at how ridiculous it is now to think back and think that everybody was worried about Internet Explorer.
On the other hand, a lot of damage can be done very quickly. So, I mean, you could argue that for the President of the United States, don't worry, for 7 years from now, it'll be gone. But, you know, what happens during those 4 or 7 years? So I think it's worth taking a look at it. I mean, actually, I've been kind of one of the biggest opponents of regulation and very concerned about the dangers of regulation. But I'm actually beginning to think that we are entering a period where the government has to be smart about it. Unfortunately, it won't. And that's
the last group I would, the two words I would not combine,
government
and government, especially when it comes to technology.
That's the problem.
And yet I'm not anti-government because there's no one else going to do it. No one's going to self-regulate. So I think that it's just government in terms of reflecting the needs of society is the only choice. But we got to get
smarter. Are the libertarians in the chat room all condemning us yet?
Oh, you know, but that's the debate. And we have this debate all the time. And I am not even sure which way to go.
Yeah,
I remember the late John Perry Barlow telling me when the net neutrality issue was hot and heavy, where they were trying to convince Tom Wheeler at the FCC to invoke Title II regulation. He said, even at the EFF, at the board meetings, we tussle with this. On the one hand, we hate the idea of government intervention in the internet. On the other hand, we know the internet needs protection, and there doesn't seem to be a straightforward, easy answer.
Right.
Actually, the Supreme Court right now is weighing a Microsoft dispute with the Department of Justice.
Yep.
This has more to do with where your data is stored.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is a fascinating story. The argument is over data stored in Ireland. Right now, stored on Microsoft servers in Dublin. It's a drug trafficking case, an Irish criminal suspect using Microsoft, I guess, I presume Hotmail or Outlook to store his mail. The DOJ wanted it. Lower court said, well, you can't have it. It's in Ireland. But now it's up the Supreme Court. The DOJ has brought it all the way to the Supreme Court. And while it's very hard to read what the Supreme Court's going to do based on oral arguments, which happened Tuesday, it does seem that at least a few of the judges are very sympathetic to the Department of Justice's stance, which would have an interesting impact on U.S. business because, you know, internet is not national, doesn't respect borders.
Right. But the problem is the Irish authority might have something to say about it. Even if the Department of Justice thinks it's okay to dip into a server house in Ireland, Ireland has a different perspective on this. So, and the other problem is, I mean, a lot of our laws, or a lot of our privacy laws, are still based on the notion of physicality,
right?
And this notion, you know, they're based on filing cabinets, right? That you can go in and what you can do with a filing cabinet. But when you're talking about cloud storage, it's a whole different animal, which gets into the, you know, a lot of the privacy laws.
And there's a corollary to this story with the case of Apple starting to store Chinese customer data in China, along with the encryption keys to access their data in China. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the other thing is that while Microsoft says that the data is stored in Ireland, in a lot of cases, particularly with cloud computing, and certainly in the case of Google's approach to it, the data is everywhere. There may be a bit of it in Ireland. There may be a bit of it in the U.S. There may be a bit of it in Brazil. And so, you know, the data may live globally as opposed to in one particular location.
Right.
Yeah. And ultimately, it's not about the location. It's about the segregating the data for people who are citizens of a specific country and then governments trying to determine what can be done with that data. It really doesn't matter where the data is stored. That's kind of a little bit of a misdirection. It's about control over what happens with people's data and trying to bring those under national laws.
But I don't know all the details on this government thing, but obviously U.S. persons are involved in this case. So it's not purely, you know, the victim, somebody here is in the United States. So it's not purely like we're trying to break into some internal Irish issue here.
Right.
The U.S., you know, the government does have an interest in this data. The question is whether they have a legal right to access it.
Right. Has Ireland said anything specifically about this case?
Do we know? Have they not? I believe they said you got to get a warrant or whatever the Irish equivalent of a warrant is.
But Microsoft controls it. I mean, and Microsoft's a U.S. country. So
A company.
That was a Freudian slip.
Right.
They used to be a country.
Yeah.
But the warrant you could serve on Microsoft that would be valid in Seattle isn't valid in Dublin unless the Irish authorities say it is valid.
Well, I'm sure they'll have something to say about it. It's a challenge, and that's part of the problem is that internet data doesn't respect national borders.
I'm not sure necessarily that it's a distraction. I think if you were going to have a good lawyer arguing that case, I think that that would be something that they would definitely bring up if they wanted to keep Google, if they wanted to keep the Google data private.
Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. If you are doing any mailing in your business, and I think most businesses do, brochures, packages. If you're an eBay or an Etsy or an Amazon seller, I'm sure you're using the U.S. Postal Service for at least some of your mail. Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services at the post office without having to go to the post office. In fact, without having to leave your desk. That's why we use it here. Our employees don't have to get up and leave the office to go to the post office. They can buy and print real U.S. postage whenever they need it, right from their computer and their printer. Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or even packages 24/7 when you need it. Any package, any class of mail. In fact, Stamps.com will save you money by suggesting less expensive classes of mail. You could mail this media, things like that. There's a great USB scale, so you always get exactly the right postage. Never have to. I still get packages from companies, PR people, product review units that have licked stamps and like 100 of them going around the side of it. And it's just not a professional look. Stamps.com, you can print right on the envelope or print a label for your package, exactly the right postage. It actually gets handled better because the indicia, the barcode that's on these labels makes it easier for the post office. You don't have to have any equipment. You don't have to have special ink. Nope, it's not a postage meter. You got everything you need right now with your computer and your printer. Stamps.com. Click, print, mail, and you're done. I use Stamps.com. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, plus that digital scale. All you have to do is go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIT. That's our offer code, and that'll let them know you heard it here first. Stamps.com. We've been using this for years. We've been talking about them for years, and I'm happy to do so because it's a great service. Stamps.com. Use the offer code TWIT. Stamps.com is convenient, easy, reliable, and efficient. And they have my stamp of approval. GitHub this week survived, and this worries me a lot, the biggest DDoS attack ever recorded. Get ready for this, 1.3 terabits per second. Now, it didn't last very long because DDoS protection, of course, GitHub had DDoS protection. Akamai's Prolexic service, they took over. After 8 minutes, the attack backed down. But the fact that an attacker could launch a 1.35 terabit attack, and it was almost certainly an amplification attack, which means that the attacker didn't have to have much bandwidth at all. Could have had a DSL dial-up modem. But because they were taking advantage of about 100,000 Memcache servers owned by businesses and other institutions that were just sitting online with no authentication, simple thing to do, the attacker just sends them a special command packet, the server replies with a much larger reply, and boom, 3.2 terabytes. That's just crazy. This is the previous largest DDoS attack, you remember from the end of 2016 when brought down the internet when the Dyn DNS service was brought down. But this was even bigger. Look at this. This is it. This is the picture. This is the spike.
Whoa.
Yow. Yow is real-time traffic. But it's kind of interesting how the mitigation's happening and how quickly it's happening now.
Amazing.
Yeah, they're prepared for this stuff. You have to throw a lot of bandwidth at the...
Do we assume this is a state-sponsored attack? I mean...
That's what's interesting about amplification attacks like this. It doesn't have to be. It could be literally a script kiddie because this Memcache flaw is well known. See, I don't want to oversell security problems, but there is an issue when security problems, it's not just your computer. It's not just you getting ransomware. You're being used for these kinds of attacks. Then it's a public health issue. Frankly.
No, it's very similar to why you want to take a flu shot, assuming they work.
Yes.
Because it's not a matter of just protecting yourself. It's a matter of protecting the herd. And that's definitely true when it comes to to cybersecurity. It's almost a patriotic thing for us all to protect our system so we don't mess up other people's systems.
Yeah, it's not about you.
It ain't about you.
Exclusively about
you. Well, it's partly about you.
Partially about you.
It's you and everybody
else. I don't want to get the flu or spread the flu.
Right. Wow. There's not a whole lot to say about it except that it happened, that it took advantage of, unpatched Memcache servers, and that capability really doesn't require a nation state. Doesn't require.
I think the biggest part of the story, that at least the one that I'm most impressed with, is the fast recovery. That's amazing.
That is truly amazing. That's a complete shift. And it just shows that people are now prepared and they're ready. And there are services like Akamai, our great friends and former sponsors at, now I can't remember the name, John Graham Cummings Company.
Hey, man, buy another ad and we'll remember the name.
Yeah, if they only bought some, actually, they are back on, so I should remember the names. Cloudflare, of course.
Cloudflare.
How could I forget? Cloudflare. You know what? I want to forget the emoji movie. Now, I know the Oscars are coming up, and we're going to wrap up because I know you all want to see the Oscars, but I don't think this is a spoiler to tell you that according to the Razzies, the emoji movie was the worst film of 2018, winning four Razzie Awards. And any movie that has Patrick Stewart as talking poo.
Ew.
Yeah. The Golden Raspberry Awards.
You got to give him credit for even taking that.
I think he must have. You know, British actors will take anything, right?
But that's right. Particularly if there's poo involved.
I think he must have just said, this would be fun. Let's do it. ladies and gentlemen, we all want to go home early because I have a blue apron to cook and a Oscars ceremony to watch.
I got a play to watch.
You got a play to go see in San Francisco, Larry Magid. Great to have you. Connect safely. Is it .org or .com? I always ask.
.org, although they both work. Officially .org.
Okay, they both work. Always a pleasure to have you, Larry. Of course, you hear him all the time, every day on CBS News Radio all over the country. And a good friend and stalwart companion. Thank you. Enjoy your play.
Thank you. I will.
Yes. Mike Elgin has wine waiting, I'm sure, or at least a comfortable bed.
Or both.
They go together in my... I always get sleepy when I have Bordeaux. I thank you so much for being here, Mike. Your travels will take you next to Italy, you said?
That's right. But right now we're in Provence getting ready for the Provence experience. So if you want to come to Provence and join us, go to gastronomad.net and sign up and come and join us.
There's still room in the Provence.
There's still room. Yep. And, slots left.
I can't wait to do... We're gonna do one of these soon, but... you're doing all over the world, and what happens is you all stay together, right? You have a place.
Right.
There's cooking involved. There's eating involved. There's wine.
We make wine, then we taste wine, then we make cheese, and we taste cheese. In Provence, we're in this big, beautiful old house, completely surrounded by lavender fields. It's just going to be amazing.
Does it have anything to do with tech, or are you a completely different?
Nothing. Leave your phones. Leave your phone in L.A., Larry. It's all about food and Provence and French culture and French people. We have a lot of friends here, actually, so we're going to actually be interacting with some of our food visionary friends. It's going to be fantastic.
So the Provence experience.
You're looking really good, by the way. Doing well for you.
I hate him. He gets better looking, thinner.
Mediterranean diet, huh?
It's
the Spartan diet. You have to ask about the Spartan diet. The Provence experience is end of June, early July this year. The Prosecco experience is coming up in May. That's the next one.
Prosecco experience.
You know how to pick them.
Yep. Morocco in 2018. That sounds so much fun. Mexico City.
Ooh.
Mexico City. Put us down for Morocco in April of next year.
We got a camel with your name on it.
When is the Mexico City experience?
That's in late December. So we're going to be there over the new year.
Let me just tell you.
That would be cool.
Mike's wife, Amira, is literally, without question, the best cook I've ever met. She had us eating a dessert that blew my mind. And then I found out it was made out of butternut squash. She is amazing. She's a genius.
She is. That's absolutely true.
Please check these out. Barcelona, yeah. September. Oh, that was the first one.
That's
what fun.
We already did that one.
Yeah,
yep.
That's. Oh, check it out, gastronomad.net.
Yeah, in the meantime, I'm still writing about tech. Oh,
I know.
I'm jealous.
I know. See, jealous. This guy figured it all out.
Really?
At least Dwight's writing about tech burgers.
That's right. I got them combined.
You'll find him at HoustonChronicle.com/techburger. We're glad to have you back in the fold.
Good to be back, and great to be back with Larry and Mike, particularly Larry, because – you know, we probably will never write another book together again, but those are some great.
Now, how did you do
that?
You
don't want to do another Vista book together? We could sell four copies.
Vista Memories.
That's right.
That would be a book.
Larry actually had started it, and you had like some health issues, right? And
couldn't
finish
the
whole thing yourself.
You know, the funny thing is I was thinking about you just yesterday. You wrote a book after the book we did together about switching from Windows to Mac.
Well, the one I wrote afterwards was about running Windows.
I want to write a book about switching from Mac to Windows. Maybe
there's a market. There's a market.
I think there will be. Yeah.
That's how you know we're old, because we've all written computer books.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
What a terrible idea.
Maybe I won't write that book.
Well, the problem with dead trees is it takes so damn long to print them up.
That's right. I think Ed Bott and
Paul
it's about
Thurrott,
the only one still left making
Paul
them.
Paul Thurrott's still writing them.
Yeah.
David Pogue's still writing them.
Oh, yeah, Pogue,
writing.
Yes.
Yeah, but they've figured it out, I guess. They must have a formula.
I was offered DOS for Dummies, and I turned it down because I didn't like that title. It sold 8 million copies.
Little did you know, Larry.
I
thought, you're demeaning your readers. Why would you say that?
That's exactly. I turned down. Mac McCarthy asked me to write. I turned him down. It sold 8 million copies. I wrote the little PC book instead, which did okay.
Which was a great book.
Well, it was enough to make a down payment on the house. If I had brought in DOS for Dummies, I could have bought several houses back then. But so be it. It's okay.
We all have stories like that, Larry.
That's right.
Thank you all for being here. We do Twit. Normally, we did a little early this week, but normally we do it 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2300 UTC on a Sunday afternoon, evening. It's always a great way to cap your week. And if I suspect some people watch live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Most people, though, and this has turned out, and it was completely by accident back in 2005 when I launched this show. Turns out people like to download podcasts Sunday night, Monday morning for their commute in on Monday. And I know that's how a lot of you listen. So you'll find it at twit.tv, like all our shows, on-demand audio and video. If you have a TV in your car, I guess, or you're on one of them fancy Uber metro train kind of a things, you can watch us. And you can subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. That's probably the best way. And don't forget, we can also be heard on all of the voice-activated devices. There's different syntax for all of them. But in general, you just ask it to listen to This Week in Tech or any of our shows, and you'll get the most recent episode. And I think more and more that's how people are going to be listening. It's just
even
so
in the car going forward.
You know, I have the Roav Viva.
Yeah, I do too.
Amazon Echo in my car. It's fantastic. I
love
audiobooks.
It.
I love it.
Yep.
And yeah, you can ask for podcasts by name. It's fantastic.
In fact, I actually was going to cancel my satellite radio until they made me such a great deal to keep it. I decided to keep it. But if they hadn't lowered the price, I would have canceled
my
satellite.
They are the kings of hard sell.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You cannot cancel Sirius XM. They just harass you to death.
Yeah, but they'll get it down to a pretty good price if you bargain.
That's good. I didn't know that. Yeah, because who needs satellite radio? You got
internet. Don't need it anymore.
You don't need that anymore.
No, the only reason I had it was a user interface, but now that I can use my voice, that's not an issue.
Your voice is the best user interface.
Exactly.
Yep.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.